Get after it, PDX. In-depth conversations with inspiring people in the creative hotbed of Portland, Oregon, and beyond. Now, let's welcome the host of Get After It PDX and the co-founder of Y East Wolfpack, Willie McBride.
Hey folks, a quick word about our sponsors. The Amesir Distilling Company, a new distillery focused on bringing people together through great flavors and a warm environment. They love the way spirits taste, but more importantly, they love that they bring people together to make memories, build bridges, and crystallize the moment. Opening in spring 2020 in Northeast Portland. Today's episode is also brought to you by Daybreak Racing, a Portland, Oregon company offering some of the finest trail running events and trail stewardship opportunities available today. Daybreak Racing has been uniting the adventurous and wild-hearted with the mountain, coast, and forest trails of the Pacific Northwest since 2016. Adventure begins at Daybreak. Visit them at daybreakracing.com.
Welcome, folks. We are back with another episode of Get After It PDX. We have yet another very, very special guest, Perry Roden, a Seattle native who is a visual and mixed media artist. So very glad to have her here today. Because she is in Seattle, this is technically a Get After It PDX and beyond. Give a warm welcome to Perry. Thanks for being here.
Yes, thank you. I like that and beyond.
And beyond, exactly. It's great.
Nice touch. I was born in Tacoma, Washington.
Okay.
And then when I was 2 years old, moved to Seattle to my grandma's house with my mom and my sister. So I've been raised in Seattle ever since. I think Seattle's, it's a beautiful place to grow up. You know, it's kind of interesting in some ways. I think a lot of folks say that, like, Seattle is very diverse, and I think that it definitely used to be, but growing up here, it was interesting because I felt like it was more, the racism is still here, and I don't really feel like it's quite as integrated as folks seem. So, you know, there's highs and lows to it, and I think that, I'm happy to be here now, even as the city is, like, changing. But, yeah, definitely, like, back in the 90s, because I'm 29, I just had a birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. You know, back in the 90s, I guess as it relates to kind of, like, art, I think the Seattle public school system was doing a really great job of just making art a priority in schools. And so, kind of, you know, how kids would bring home if they had, like, an essay and they got, like, an A on it or something like that, their parents would put it on the refrigerator. Mm-hmm. My mom did that with the art projects that I would bring home. So if it was, like, a paper mache or a painting, watercolor, whatever, she decorated our house with it. So in terms of, feeling valued and sort of my, like, confidence with my art, I didn't even realize that until recently, but she's been supporting me, like, with that ever since I was a kid. So that's pretty cool.
That's very cool. Yeah,
I still have some of them. Some of them are trash, but you know, in the moment I needed to, you know, finger paint or whatever. And then I would say that when it came time for me to figure out where I wanted to go for college, you know, I was like, let me get as far away from home as humanly possible while still in the U.S. And I really wanted to, like, be around... I'm black, by the way, for those, obviously, we're on Shay's side, but for those that are listening, I'm a black woman, and so for me, a part of wanting to just lean more into my culture, I was like, let me go to Howard University, which is a HBCU in Washington, Washington, D.C. And it was there that I, like, decided to become an artist. When I initially went into it, I didn't know kind of what I wanted to major in. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I just was having the best time of my life, my, like, freshman and sophomore year.
Hey, real quick, what's HBCU again?
Historic Black College and University.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, of course. And so, I guess I should say, are you familiar with Howard or with, like, historical black colleges?
Well, I was actually going to say, isn't Howard a historic black college? I didn't know that acronym. So I've heard about it, and I did associate it as being
HBCU.
One of a place that is primarily black student body. But beyond that, I don't. Right, I know there's a few colleges and universities like that, but beyond that, I don't really know all that much about it.
Yeah, they're definitely spread all around the country, mostly, in my opinion, on, like, the East Coast and in the South.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's, don't quote me on that, in terms of the number of schools that there are, but I think Howard is one of the best. So, and also just, like, Howard being in D.C., I wanted to, I guess a part of, like, my personal process that also affects my art. I love to travel. I love kind of just that fast-paced edge of the East Coast. And then, like, on a, in terms of, like, a geographical standpoint, you know, from D.C., you can get to New York in hours. You can go to Philly and all of that. So I just was like, let me explore this region. And so kind of getting back to the art, I didn't know what I wanted to major in. And someone told me, when you don't know what to do, just try a whole bunch of shit that you are interested in. So I took some women's studies classes, some, like, really cool, like, African art classes, and I also took figure painting. And that was probably, like, sorry, not finger painting. Figure painting.
No, I heard it as figure.
Okay, good. I was like, let me be clear. that class was awesome. And I think the best part about it is that there were students who were in so many different programs. So art wasn't necessarily their major. This was like an elective.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, of being in the room with future doctors, future chemists, you know, communications folks, and we're all painting, like, each other and, like, black models and having, like, vivid conversations about just, like, our culture and identity. And I was like, this is the best. So I checked in with my parents and I was like, hey, would y'all support me if I, you know, decided to major in art? And, like, Both my parents said yes. And so from there, it's just, I mean, I can get further into the details, probably will, but that's kind of how I, sort of my, like, my background as an artist, and then the beginning pivot to deciding that I should, like, make a career out of it.
Yep. What did your folks do as careers, or how'd they spend their time?
Yeah, so my father was in the Army, and then when he finished, he started working at USPS, and so he's a postman.
Mm-hmm.
He loves to walk, so I think that's the perfect job for him. Like, he's so into, like, sports and nature and, like, physical wellness and inner wellness, and so in terms of, like, Seattle nature and, like, wellness, I definitely get that from him.
Nice.
Yeah, hiking and frisbee, and he literally was the reason why I was exposed to, like, so many things that the Seattle School District, you know, didn't really, like, provide.
Yeah.
And then my mom, she was working at Verizon as a, she was in HR at Verizon, And then while I was in school, super badass, she went back to school and got her teaching degree. And so now she's a kindergarten teacher just like right up the street.
Wow. That's really cool. And did you have siblings?
Yeah, I have one sister. We're 2.5 years apart. And she is an entrepreneur as well. She went to Pepperdine University. Her name's Taylor Roden. She does events, communication. She's a communication director at one nonprofit here. She wears so many different hats that are focused on community, bringing folks together, events, a little bit of nonprofit development. Like, she's, I don't even know how to describe her sometimes. I just let her introduce herself.
Sounds pretty cool.
Yeah.
Who is the older sister?
You know, I used to ask that question to, new friends, to strangers. And then by asking that question, I realized only the younger sibling would probably ask that. So I'm younger. She's 2.5 years older.
Nice. Did you find her influential as you were growing up?
100%. I mean, we joke about it, but she really was and is my first friend. So I think in terms of my personal development and learning how to share and think of others and, you know what I mean? I think siblings really help in that way. Not saying that, if you are an only child, you won't have that, but I think there definitely is something special, I think, about having siblings. And yeah, and I think the other cool part too is, two kids can be born and raised in the same household and turn out completely different. And I think even just kind of stepping back and analyzing that is amazing. It is really cool having an older sister who kind of leads the way. I'm really happy that we didn't have a kid after me. I wouldn't really want to be in the middle. So I love being the baby, and I love being able to look forward and have her back, and then she has mine. So yeah, we're really close.
Nice. I always ask people, when you were in high school, often older folks would say, what do you want to be when you grow up? What would you have said?
I'm also the type of person where someone asks me what my favorite something is, and it always changes. What's your favorite color?
Yeah, I hate those questions overall.
What's your favorite thing to eat? And I also feel to directly answer your question, I have no idea what I said. And it probably changed from, person to person, but... I think that, I wish that instead of asking young people, what do you want to be when you grow up, redirecting that question to, what are you interested in? What do you naturally have? What are your natural abilities or talents? What do you want to change in the world? Or what do you feel like you haven't, or... I don't know, it's a weird question to ask, what does someone feel like they haven't been exposed to? But I feel like those are the types of questions, especially in, people ask, 6-year-olds what they want to be when they grow up. It's like,
it's not a good question, right? It's sort of an outdated, it's implying that we're meant to be one thing or one profession, and that's what you do for your whole life, and that's how you define yourself.
Yeah.
And it does seem for the better that more and more people are doing a bigger variety of things and changing careers at all ages. And
I also just feel like in this day and age with technology and how we have access to so many things, and I feel like our parents and our grandparents, they had, they have that very singular, I'm going to be an accountant. And they kept that job for 30 years, you know what I mean? And I feel like now it's kind of assumed that you have a day job, but what else do you do? What are your other hobbies or interests? Or how else are you making money outside of just your 9-to-5? Yep. At least in my circles, that's you know, I have a friend who, she works in the hospitality industry, which because of COVID, you know, that's taking its own interesting, you know, twist and turn, but she upcycles candles.
Huh.
Yeah, so, or she upcycles, like, bottles and then turns them into candles.
Okay.
Yeah, so I feel like, I think she started out by doing that maybe more for herself, you know, in terms of, like, a hobby and artistic expression, and then and now she has, like, an Instagram page and is shipping them, like, all over the U.S. and stuff like that, so... Yeah,
well,
I think it just...
That's cool.
Yeah.
So, by going to this historically all-black college, you said you felt, you know, that you needed more of that culture and wanted to get more into that. Did you feel that was lacking? I mean, obviously you touched upon Seattle, you know, is known to be diverse, but maybe wasn't... You weren't finding the community that.
Yeah.
So what was that experience like being growing up in Seattle as a black person?
Yeah. So I'll try to stay focused with like three major points here. So growing up in Seattle in the 90s and like early 2000s, gentrification was happening, but it didn't. Like a lot of my friends were starting to move farther south into like Tacoma, Puyallup, Des Moines, but I didn't quite know why. And so I did see diversity in my elementary school and my middle schools. And then in high school, by the time I got to high school, I'd say that I went to Garfield High School. It was about kind of like half white and then half like black brown.
Mm.
And so in my like elementary experience, elementary school and like daycare kind of era, that was beautiful. If I could recreate that for my future children, like that is my goal, where not only was my school actually diverse, but the multiple cultures were actually celebrated. So there wasn't this kind of feeling that like that white culture was kind of the standard or like elevated. It actually felt as if all of our voices were kind of being put into the forefront. By the time I got to middle school, I dealt with bullying. I was at a predominantly black and brown middle school for like sixth grade. This isn't like a, I don't mean to like play a small violin here, but mm-hmm. I was bullied. I was bullied not only, I was bullied by other black children for not being black enough, or for like having too much money where, like, I didn't know what ramen noodles were, or just kind of...
So you were... Or your family was more financially secure, more privileged than most of the other families around you, or some of these other people who were bullying you for it, at least.
Kind of, yeah, in terms of, like, I wouldn't necessarily more financially secure, it just was more of I was otherized by what my blackness looked like. And so in my household, we just had like, there were certain things that my mom allowed us to eat, and they were a little bit like healthier than what some of the kids in my middle school, like they were allowed to eat in theirs. So the junk food, the like beverages, I don't know. And that's the thing about like bullying, and it's like something that is so kind of micro or small can be just kind of like taken out of context and then Yeah, and then just to make someone feel bad or less than because they don't have those experiences. And so I was bullied in like 6th and 7th grade, and then actually got into like a couple fights at school.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when my mom switched me to a different middle school, which was more predominantly white across town. So in terms of like my experience of being bullied by and otherized by folks who look just like me, but then also kind of not fully healing from that and going into a new school and into high school, it was just an interesting kind of, in terms of like my identity that was forming, there were a lot of different pieces that were put into place. And so, and in terms of like kind of the makeup of Seattle at that time, my high school was about half white, half black, but it definitely felt more segregated in terms of how the students kind of interacted with each other. There definitely was like, you know, crossover of like sports and clubs and different ways that like hobbies and stuff like that. But, you know, with like the AP programs and honors and then like the regular classes, it just, all these social structures started to come into place.
Mm-hmm.
I was more aware of how I fit both in this environment at school, but also in my community. I was going to church in like a very predominantly like white area of town, the east side of mm-hmm. Seattle, or like the east side of like the greater Seattle, like Bellevue, Woodinville, Redmond, and all of that. So by the time that I turned 17, I was like, how can I get the fuck out of here and have a great time somewhere else? So I applied to two schools in California. My school of choice here was Wazoo, although I didn't really want to live in Pullman, so it's kind of my safety school. But for all those that are listening, Wazoo is a great school. I just personally did not want to be there. And then the only other school that I applied to was Howard. And so when Howard said yes, and they're like, I didn't get into one. The other one said they never got my application. And then I was waitlisted in another. I was like, you know what? I'm out of here. So
it was just, I mean, I can imagine it was, but just difficult because, I mean, it was just sort of this identity struggle in all these different ways, and it just wasn't a fun, easy high school experience.
Not really. I definitely had more fun in college, and I think what I learned, kind of getting back to your original question, because I kind of forgot for a second on that ramble, but
no worries.
I think a part of what I thought Howard was going to be was, I was like, oh, I bet there's like really cute guys there. And then I also was like, I'm curious as to like what that like education will look like. And then my sister's best friend was also at Howard, so I was hearing from her about how amazing it was and how amazing DC was. And I think my idea of both trying to get out of the petri dish of Seattle, but also wanting to like lean more into like just black culture and the kind of perks of being at an HBCU, those were my driving forces as to why I wanted to go.
Yep.
And then once I got there, I think a lot of people in college feel this way, where you make truly like lifelong friends. And I think it was so beautiful to know that, kind of taking it full circle of, I met people who had my experience, I met people who had like 100% like black school experiences, I met people from the Caribbean, people from London, and I feel like the common thread was that we all felt this sense of kind of misplacement or kind of maybe like a just a desire to be around each other. And I think that helped me feel less alone in my singular experience, because I knew that there were people who also felt this type of need, who were in drastically different circumstances than I was in, if that makes sense.
So you would say you mentioned your future children, would you send them to a HBCU?
Yeah, I think that it depends on how the school is doing. I think for me, I needed that, but I wouldn't impose that on my kids if that's not what they wanted. Mm-hmm. I think that the HBCU experience was great. I love Howard. There's also, you know, there's areas that need improvement, and I'm saying that in a very kind way. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think if my future kids wanted to go, cool, but if they didn't want to go and they want to go somewhere else, I think it's more about just, like, identifying, like, where you are in your life, what it is that you want, scholarships, financial aid, and then kind of going from there.
So this class you took in college that you said was so pivotal for you, you said it was figure drawing?
I can't remember which one came first, but there was, I think it was figure painting, but figure I also painting. Took a lot of figure drawing classes as okay. well.
But it's a figure-based, what, because now, obviously, your art, you do a lot of feminine forms and really a ton of celebration of the female form and bodies and tons of beautiful work. So what, especially from that first sort of experience that sparked this now ongoing interest, what about it was so attractive to you or fascinating to you?
Until that point, all of the art teachers or art projects were always kind of about, we're going to draw a tree, or it wasn't personal. And I think the piece of why that class meant so much to me, especially in a time where I was trying to I was already reflecting and trying to think about what do I want, right? That class was great because it caused me to think about myself and to look around the room and see all of these, black women and all of their different, careers or whatever degree that they were trying to pursue, where they were from, and I guess context is that at the time that I was at Howard, the ratio of men to women was about 9 women to one man. So it often felt right. So it was like,
whoa,
I arrived and I saw that there were only a handful of dudes, and I was.
Yeah, I was about to say your theory about finding cute dudes, at least maybe low numbers. But.
So the majority of my classes actually were women, and there were a sprinkling of men. Wow. And so being in, which was both great but also kind of sucked, but in this instance, in my art classes, that actually was quite beautiful. And I think there were times where different students offered to pose, or we would, some of the prompts were draw a portrait either of yourself, of someone in the class, or, find a portrait or a picture to reference. And so I think the foundational elements of my art focusing on the female form, the female body, was celebrating acknowledging and kind of highlighting the beauty of the people who were in that class, and also in myself. So there were a lot of self-portraits, but then also kind of as a visual artist, there's a different type of emotion and like energy transfer that you can pick up when someone is modeling, when they're modeling live versus when you reference a photo. Mm-hmm. And so I began to notice that the getting models was a little bit of various kind of like shapes and colors, and also the vulnerability of modeling. Like, as I was trying to actually learn the curves of the female form, having, you know, nude models, actually it was more preferred and is preferred for me because I can actually see the shapes more versus clothing distorting. And so it was hard to find nude models for me. So then I realized, okay, well, I need to be my own model. So I would either record myself or take pictures or literally paint or draw myself while looking at my own reflection in ways to strengthen my skill set. And slowly but surely, I actually am, to this day, I use my own features when I am creating forms in my work. So a lot of the work actually, you could say in a way that they're inspired self-portraits. And I'm working on building a budget to where I can actually pay for models going forward, because I mean, I love myself. I love painting myself, but I really want to paint other body shapes and fuller figured women. So that's kind of how the figurative element started with my work. And then I'd say from about the time that I started that program in 2012 to maybe started to explore, like, there was a point where I started to get really frustrated with the female form, and I realized I was much more of an abstract artist rather than a realist or realism, kind of in that spectrum. And so I started working on, I don't even remember which painting it was, but I remember getting so frustrated that I had a blank canvas next to me, and I just started kind of like doodling and then constantly turning the canvas. And I was like, you know what, I feel like coloring. So I've added like colored pencils, and slowly but surely, over like maybe a 9-month period, almost to a year, I created a painting which I now call Spotty Oddy Dopealicious off of the Outkast song. And it was that moment where I realized, oh, I don't have to have a figure in my work at all, and it can still be really dope. And so that painting has since inspired the direction that I'm going in now, where, yes, I'll still reference the female form, but I'm abstracting it even further and then kind of creating my own imaginary world on canvas and adding those two together.
I love that image, the Spodiary Dopealicious. That's great. I would imagine that the process of using the female form as your subject matter, and you specifically, your own body as the subject matter, would give you a better and better appreciation of your own body.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause obviously a lot of people have a lack of appreciation or love for their own form sometimes. So I bet that was a good outcome of all that.
Yeah, and I think the other piece too, so in terms of trying to find, right, because if you think about kind of my process of, wow, like, I want to paint, or I want to draw or sketch, or I want a woman to be in this image. If I can't create that myself, either with my own body, if I don't have the funds to be able to pay a model to do it, then the next step is, can I find something on social media that is close to the position that I want, and then try to kind of work it out from there by using, you know, both my body and other bodies. And so that, even in that process, and talking about the female body and like media and social media and the way that, I don't know, I guess the way that women portray themselves on social media, I think that I've seen it be extremely vulnerable and beautiful, and then I've also seen where it could be kind of toxic in the sense that, like, of the need of, like, so many filters or of so many edits or not feeling comfortable in their body and the way that it is. And I think that what I try to do with my art is empower women to see and love their body as it is, and also just to be, and to kind of just be conscious of the fact that, like, our bodies are going to grow, they're going to stretch, they're going to shrink, and being confident and allowing that to happen, that's sort of like the underlying message, and that's kind of what I talk about my art. That's what I want people to take away.
So I want to talk about the sort of intersection of art and activism, but that got me to thinking that even working with the female form is a form of activism, or that's a form that's political as well, because obviously sort of, or, you know, there's many, many overlapping issues there in terms of women's bodies and laws that pertain to women's bodies and all those things. But so yeah, let's talk about art and activism. You're wearing a shirt that says a bunch of names. Those are all names of people who have been killed by police in the past. So obviously that's a topic that is very pertinent right now. Obviously that's something that's gone on through the history of our whole country, but as we're at a very unique point right now, where it's really on a topic that is things are happening. Do you feel like things are genuinely changing, or what's your sort of take on where we're at right now? Oh, that could be like five episodes, yeah.
I think that in some areas I think things are changing, others I don't at all. And I think that this definitely feels different than it has in the past, since, you know, for me. But I mean, I don't know how to answer that question. I think it's a great one, but I think that, like, I have hope that things are changing on an individual level, and then even since all the protests started, there still have been videos and reports of Black people still being killed, still being tormented by the police, and also being harassed by other American citizens. So I want to say that things are getting better, but even though the media were highlighted, like, the Black Lives Matter movement it kind of feels as if it's tapering off, and I don't know if it's tapering off because conversations are being taken place where, like, there's this awareness of, hey, we don't actually have to say that Black Lives Matter because they should just matter. But I also don't know if the reason why it's kind of tapering off in the media is because it's, like, no longer, like, relevant or important. I don't know.
No, maybe, I mean, that's not a great question, I guess. And I didn't mean that. The question wasn't, is it getting better? Is it changing? Because obviously change can still take a while. Anyway, that was really all to say that it does feel like something is different now, at least. Or, you know, like they're like when Black Lives Matter first became a thing, like Ferguson and Michael Brown, you know, that was its own sort of moment in time that seemed significant. But like, even now, this seems much different. I mean, I guess just the time we're in, given a pandemic and everything, is tensions of all sorts are running super high.
I think that the, when we talk about like change, right, the top name on my shirt is in it. Emmett Till happened, like his death happened, I think in like the 1950s or something like that. Don't quote me on the exact date because I'm not the best historian, but, and that's the hard part. Like, I'm happy that it feels different now. I do agree I'm having more conversations, more nuanced conversations with folks now than I did like a year ago or maybe 2 years ago. But this has been happening for years, decades. You know, slavery happened 400 years ago. And so I think a part of what I'm realizing in this moment is that each generation has its own kind of stage of progress, and then it kind of feels like it tapers away, and then there's another generation and they have progress. But how do we actually do some like Game of Thrones Khaleesi type shit where we're actually breaking the wheel? And I don't know if that's ever gonna happen. And that's more of me being a realist rather than being negative. But
yeah.
I guess I'll put it to you this way. I still have anxiety about where I go, what I say, who I'm with. And I even just yesterday of going to, of driving in my car with three of my friends, to like go deliver like a birthday balloon to one of our friends whose birthday was yesterday. Like, that level of awareness and anxiety of, are we going to get home safe? I felt that 3 weeks ago. I felt that a year ago. I felt that 5 years ago. And so, and that's the other thing too, even from the time that I was raised, right? My mom, my family, my community, we've always had these conversations of awareness and colorism and of just racism and how to navigate those conversations and how to get home safe. And the fact that Breonna Taylor was home in her bed and was murdered by the police. I don't know the young lady's name, but just like in the last week, there was a woman who was in her home, a Black woman in her home, in her shower, and she was arrested and then literally pulled out by the police, naked, bleeding. She was on her cycle and arrested for, I guess, a crime that like her brother committed, but he was already in jail when that took place. So it's like, I want to say that there is change, but then shit like that happens where I'm like, I don't even, in a place that I have been, this home that I'm in right now, I've been here my entire life, and even these walls can't protect me. So until we have change that touches that, I don't really, it's hard for me to quantify the type of progress that we've made in the last 3 months. Yeah. And I think the other, if I'm being quite honest, I think a huge reason as to why the Black Lives Matter movement, even, you can't really talk about the move, the Black Lives Matter movement that happened from like March to, you want to say right now, without talking about the pandemic and the fact that like everyone was working from home. And so, in my opinion, the reason why so many people showed up to these like protests and marches was because they had the time and availability to do so. But I don't honestly think the numbers would have been the same if we were not in this pandemic. That's kind of how I feel about it.
Yeah, thank you for sharing. So, well, so one of the ways I first discovered you and your artwork was because you had painted one of the letters of the Black Lives Matter mural in Seattle. So we don't need to get into the whole deal with where that was and how that's changed. And so that was in this Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone that had its whole own creation and now has been disbanded. Is that correct? So anyway, but so just with you using art as a form of activism, is that something you, or like, was that the first time you had directly like been involved with like a political mural type thing?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, even I'd say 3 years ago with like, I didn't, when I was trying to like apply for different like art calls or grants that were specifically looking for art that was centered around activism, I didn't feel as if my art fit into those guidelines and parameters. Mm-hmm. And I think in terms when we look at art as activism, or at least the way that I do, I thought that it had to look more like social justice, like forward, or for it to visually look a kind of in a certain way or in a box. And so I didn't really identify that my art was my activism back then. Mm-hmm. But just through conversations that I've had with some of the muralists that were part of the Black Lives Matter mural, me living my Black life, I already am an activist. And so, like, I'm living and breathing that activism every time that I show up and that I speak. And so, as it relates to this mural, that was the first time I participated in more of like a guerrilla style, like, let's go out and like fuck up these streets and like write Black Lives Matter. And I think that it was definitely beautiful, but I'd much rather create art for me, I don't really do the street style of art. And so the idea of being arrested for making art legally, I didn't really think about that while we were out there at CHOP, but since then, I've realized, you know, that doesn't necessarily sit with me, so I'd rather do a public art mural when I'm commissioned and there's more, you know, parameters around it. But yep. All in all, that mural was amazing. It definitely was the first time I did something like that. it's been so great getting to know the artists that were involved. So, like, the only reason why I was asked, the organizer reached out and had, like, a post. It was very vague, and I get why. So I responded, and I was like, hey, there's an opportunity to, like, paint. I'm totally down. And then from there, they gathered these 15, 16 artists, and she told us the scope of what was happening, that it was, like, going to be, like, the next 1 to 2 days, so to be ready. And it was, looking back on it, it was really cool. I felt very anxious while being at CHOP, because that was my first time in that space. Mm-hmm. And so the anxiety that I was telling you about that I feel every day with literally going to the store, now I'm going into this occupied protest. And so my focus was just on put your headphones on, create this artwork, make it meaningful and representative of who you are, and make sure that you get home safe. And it also was really nice that, like, it was combed off, so there weren't, and then also kind of just, like, germs and people and breathing and sneezing and all that. That was an added element too. But it was nice that it was completely combed off so that we were the only ones inside creating. Mm-hmm. So there also was this kind of feeling of, it was camaraderie, but it also was I know that there are people here where if something happened to me, they would 100% know. So that felt safe, even though I didn't necessarily feel as safe at CHOP.
Yeah, I actually just the other day had Barry Johnson on the podcast.
Nice. I love Barry. Yeah. His art is incredible.
He seems very amazing. I listened to his TED talk about personas, and it was amazing. He's a very cool guy. Anyway, so one more sobering or another sort of sobering topic to continue on that ties really directly into Seattle, and you already used the term and mentioned this, is, you know, gentrification. Obviously, as somebody who grew up in Seattle, you've seen immense change in the city, you know, with Amazon coming in, and it's like, so I'm down in Portland, of course, 3 hours south, and things have changed drastically here, but you sort of hear about Seattle as like the, you know, almost like San Francisco level pinnacle of, like, just things have gotten so expensive, so crazy, so extreme gentrification. So I haven't done all the research to get the details, but it did appear that something came out recently in the Breonna Taylor case that her house and her, I don't know, her block or whatever was in the process or being sold or attempted to be sold for, basically, to be torn down for development.
I heard about that too.
So, yeah, it seems then that there was some correlation that, you know, between trying to forcibly or violently get rid of these people so that, you know, these old houses can be torn down and new houses can be built and money made and all this stuff. So what, you know, is Seattle, what are your views on Seattle these days, given the extremity of that sort of gentrification change? Is it still a place you love? And I mean, you obviously still live there, but it's, so it hasn't been enough that you want to leave, but, you know, like a lot of people lament, like, oh, there's old Portland and new Portland, and it's like this tragic thing. And how do you sort of see it up there?
Breonna Taylor, and the fact that that information has come out about her block being sold, to me, that actually gives further cause as to why the police officers have not been arrested, because they probably, in my opinion, were directed and or are working with the folks who are trying to gentrify that area. So that makes complete sense to me. I don't know if it does for others, but I see that direct correlation. And then in terms of Seattle, so in 2015, I moved back to Seattle from DC. The main reason why I moved, it was very expensive in DC, and I was working two jobs and not necessarily making as much art and increasing my network there because of my work schedule. That with a little bit of a broken heart and a bad breakup, I moved home. And so I've been here ever since, working on myself, furthering my craft. And I would say that maybe this time last year, I started to, I love Seattle. There's parts of it that I know that I can't recreate in other areas of the U.S. Like, I'll probably show you today's the most beautiful day. Like, beautiful. But I don't actually want to live here long term. I'm more moved home to kind of reset, recalibrate, get a new strategy. And so because of COVID and basically not in every other country saying like, you dirty Americans, y'all stay in your filth, you can't come here. I haven't been able to travel. So this year I actually was planning on traveling and visiting other cities to see where do I want to move to next. And I think that kind of touching on your other question, the reason why, like with Seattle and gentrification, it is just as expensive here as it is in DC. I think every metropolitan city at this point is expensive as fuck to live in. And Seattle, I'd say kind of the old Seattle, in my opinion, it's kind of, in areas, it's kind of gone. I think that gentrification has a very interesting visual aesthetic in terms of the colors, the architecture, the materials that they use for these, like, what are they called? Like, those like mini apartments, the pods and stuff like that. Like, they all have this very interesting look, and I feel like old Seattle, it had that historic kind of charm where the buildings were, you know, different heights, different finishes. And so aesthetically, the architecture of the city is changing. And so every time that I'm going down a street or, you know, going through a neighborhood, I'm constantly reminded of what is now here versus what used to be there. So there's kind of a sadness in that.
Yeah.
But in terms of what Seattle is like now, it feels as if white culture is the standard, and there's not necessarily integration of other cultures into these work environments, and I've worked in nonprofit, I've worked in like a private country club, I've worked at grocery stores, and retail, so I have a really nice little kind of resume of places that I've worked and skills that I've had outside of my art. But in every business, there's more room that's made for like LGBTQIA than there is, which is good, but there's not room for like the intersectionality of race with that in these spaces. It still is binary, and then it's inclusive of the LGBTQIA community, but there's not the intersectionality of race in that, so it still feels very toxic. And that's kind of where I'm like, you know, I think that I could have my roots here, but then use my art as a vehicle for me to be able to go to different cities and kind of live in maybe two places at once type of thing. But also Seattle from like October, wet, not fun. So my plan is to find a new place that I want to live, where I could live half the year there and maybe half the year here, so that I don't feel stifled by Seattle.
What are some of the cities on your list?
Well, mind you, these are places that I've, you know, like you go to travel with like family or friends or bachelorette party or something. It's a very different type of mindset versus if you're thinking to live somewhere. So a couple people said, I don't really want to move back to, I don't want to do New York, it's a little too much. Someone told me Albuquerque, and then the other city in New Mexico, I can't remember what it is.
Santa Fe,
which has its both positives and negatives. Someone else told me I should look into like just like the Northern California region. LA has way too much traffic and way too much, has its own toxic shit. So I don't want to do that. But like a Northern California where it's like warmer, not San Francisco. I don't know. We'll see. And honestly, like, I love New Orleans. Love New Orleans. But I don't know, with the weather and hurricanes and, like, floods, if I could handle that. So if you have any suggestions, or if anyone has suggestions for me from this podcast, please get in contact and let me know. I mean, it doesn't really seem like I'll be able to actually physically visit these places anytime soon, but I'm definitely looking for, like, a place where there is like a good art kind of base. Because I don't want to like, yeah, the idea of going to a place that's smaller than Seattle does not work for me. It has to be the size of Seattle or bigger.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, you should come visit Portland just because it's close and we could show you a good time, but
yeah,
that wouldn't fall into the criteria. It's a bit, it's smaller and too close for you, probably.
Yeah, I do love visiting Portland, though. I've gone to Portland a handful of times. A couple of my friends live in Oregon, so I love like driving through. I love your thrift in Portland too. I love thrifting.
Oh yeah. So, if you thus far in your life and career, what would you say have been your, I mean, like you said, there's always challenges, especially as a person of color and living in this country, and there's anxieties that are going to be basically ever present, but what are some of the bigger sort of, if there were ones, stumbling blocks along the way, and maybe that, or maybe just in terms of your art career, like, you know, oftentimes it's hard for people to stay motivated to pursue a passion like that, that requires a ton of practice and work and, you know, constant going towards this goal. Were there stumbling blocks along the way that you experienced? Or times where you like questioned the path ahead?
Oh, 100%. I think, I deal with seasonal depression. Mm-hmm. So I definitely go through phases where I can get really down on myself and question whether or not I should continue doing my art. But I've also created measures where when I have those thoughts, I look back on journals or videos or pictures and also reached out to people to like help bring me back up and remind me of how amazing I am and my work and the impact that I make. I would say stumbling blocks. Yeah, that's a tough one because so January of this year, I committed to being a full-time artist. And so from the time I graduated up until 2019, I always kind of had a part-time job or a full-time job, or I was kind of flexing between the two. And definitely along the way, I considered like, you know, should my art just be a hobby? How do I find the balance between paying my bills and feeling or having the time or creative energy to invest in making new work? And I started working at a tech company last year. And so when I was working there, I started to think, you know, do I want to pivot from art into tech? Can I find a creative outlet in tech or creative field? And so I think there definitely are moments and places along my journey where I've considered or wondered or questioned, is this the route that I want to take? But I firmly believe that the last maybe 2 years have confirmed that that answer is yes, keep going. And I think the kind of encouraging word that I would give to artists, or even it really can apply to any career, is that it's going to take a while for the flowers to show, but that doesn't mean that there's not growth happening underneath the surface. And if you can put measures in place or find ways to build yourself back up before you see those flowers, like it will be worth it. And so for me, those, like the recent accomplishments have been, I applied for a public art mural in the Central District, and I won and I got it. Nice. So that building or that mural is associated with Midtown. It's on 23rd and Union in Seattle. And so myself, along with 7 other artists, once the building is actually like, you know, created, then I'll go in and install a mural. So that was huge. And then I finished a mural on 23rd in Massachusetts outside of the African American Museum. A friend of mine, Melvin Freeman, reached out to me and asked if I would create a backdrop mural to his installation. So between those public art murals, the Black Lives Matter mural that I was asked to be a part of, and all of the beautiful like development and growth and friendships that's happened from there, to I moved from my smaller studio into a larger one. So I think it's more of like there are all of these things where in the moment, day to day, I'm like, whew, what are we going to tackle today? And then it doesn't necessarily, I don't always feel the impact of what it is that I'm doing. But once I take a step back and look at the big picture of my life from the time that I brought home my first finger painting to my mom, to making it out of Seattle, to graduating from college, deciding to pursue art, moving home, feeling as if I was at rock bottom, and in 5 years, now I've created, I think, maybe 4 or 5 murals. More on the way. You know, I think it's all about perspective and just making sure that you're constantly reflecting as much as you're also planning, and just make sure that you are staying encouraged and are following the course, because it will work out. It just, it may take a little longer, and or the small kind of, I think as an entrepreneur and as a small business owner, there are little small wins that happen that like no one else will understand, like switching, like once you actually start to implement contracts into what you're doing, like that's actually huge, because a lot of people, a lot of artists don't, we should, but that doesn't mean we actually are using contracts, right? Mm-hmm. But actually like folding that into your system, that's huge within itself. Or switching to, you know, using like PayPal and having a card reader or whatever that may be, like make sure you're celebrating those wins, even if to the outside world it doesn't seem as if that's huge. It actually takes a ton of work to set that up. So just reframing my mind and making sure I'm celebrating my growth.
I love it. Yeah, people definitely lose sight of that so much. So quickly they like forget how far they've come. It's shocking sometimes. We're definitely winding down. You sort of took away one of the questions, which was I always close by asking people their advice for people who are sort of on the journey of figuring out their passion or their path. So you sort of touched on that. So one thing I do want to ask, because you know, in the Pacific Northwest is so beautiful, the outdoors are absolutely amazing, very lucky. And we spend a ton of time outdoors. We love running and hiking and walking around and enjoying the mountains and,
yeah,
and the water. So obviously we've talked about the artistic influence of the female form and all that, which is, you know, a form of nature for sure. Do you get inspiration from the natural surroundings in Seattle area?
Hell yes. 100%. Like in terms of like aesthetically, I feel like I draw a connection with when I use kind of like my line work, right? Creating the natural curves of the female form, to if I'm like drawing hair and like there's like these curvilinear lines that I feel exist on our bodies that also exist in nature. Mm-hmm. And so that being like a tree or like plants, I cross those two. And so there's definitely like more like natural elements integrated into kind of my designs. But then also on a personal level, like I love getting out in nature and going on hikes, going on bike rides, and just getting away from this capitalistic society and getting away from people and kind of all the things that I've touched on, and just breathing in fresh, beautiful, clean air. I know that Seattle specifically, like there's literally a playground around us of different places to go to get that sense of like restoration and like sense of peace. Mm-hmm. And even when you think about kind of like the color palettes that we see in nature, my artwork is very colorful in the sense that I use literally every color in the crayon box. Mm-hmm. But I try to get inspiration and that sense of freedom that I feel when I'm in nature, and then transfer that into my work. So like today, I plan on going on a bike ride. Mm-hmm. And going out to the beach, bringing some art supplies, taking pictures, and just relaxing. So that'll be my, like, sorry, that'll be, like, my evening.
Oh, yeah. Sounds amazing.
Yeah, let me actually show you how beautiful today is. I think you're going to be a little jealous.
Like, seriously, a beautiful day in Seattle, there's nothing like it. Oh, whoa, nice spot you got there.
Thank you. The Pacific Northwest, it's beautiful, and so that's a part of why I'm like, I definitely want to live somewhere else for, you know, a handful of reasons, but I also 100% know that, like, the beauty of this region, it just can't be replicated, and it's not replicated, like, anywhere else. So, like, that, there's kind of, like, a soul of the nature here, and, like, it's really nice feeling that. Thank you so much for your time and for the interview.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Cool. All right, talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
This wraps up another edition of the Get After It PDX podcast. For more information about today's guest, including social media links, please check out the show notes for this episode. Thanks for listening. Now it's your turn to get out there and get after it.